The following is a paid presentation. The views and opinions expressed do not necessarily reflect those of WIFE or Whitewater Broadcasting. It's time for To Your Health, brought to you by Rush Memorial Hospital. A weekly visit with the healthcare professionals at Rush Memorial to introduce you to the employees and the various programs at the hospital. And now, your host, Mary Frances Friedel.
Good morning. We're here today with Dr. Saba Shark Sarin, who is our new pain management specialist at Rush Memorial Hospital. And he is here to talk about the steps that he takes in treating patients for pain management so that the patients will know what to expect when they come to his office.
Pleasure to be here again.
I have never been to a pain management specialist. Could you maybe explain where you start out and the steps that you take in progressing towards treating a patient?
So I think pain management treatments at RMH, in broader respect, when you visit any specialist, begin with a comprehensive evaluation and physical examination of the patients. At that point, we may offer testing from blood work, imaging, etc. When I construct a pain plan for my patients, I tend to start with treatments that are least invasive and carry the least amount of risk for the greatest potential of reward. More invasive or risky treatments are tried only after the low-risk treatments have been exhausted and have failed to resolve the problem. I personally call this conservative pain management. It is really important that the pain management provider keeps the patient informed of the potential risks and rewards of each stage of treatment so patients can make informed decisions about their own care. The initial evaluation and intake is very important, as I will get to personally know the patient and his or her other medical problems, such as kidney or liver function, heart or lung problem, because they play a crucial role in metabolism and clearance of those medications.
You mentioned wanting patients to be informed so they can make decisions about their care. So does this mean that you basically are sort of engaging in a collaboration with the patients so that the patients are going to give some input? You're not just saying, oh, go do this, go take this.
And I think patients should be informed, and it is the patient's right to choose a treatment plan. Let's talk about compliance in this instance. I often tell the patients that a medical plan for a patient is similar to a phone number. You have to have all the numbers, but also you have to dial them in the right sequence in order to get to the destination. That's why compliance with medical advice is of a great importance in any field of medicine. Doctors are advocates of patient health, and they are passionate about making them feel better, but it's at the end the patient's decision to engage in their own medical care. Just to make an example, in most cases, we start with a medication. It often takes 2 to 4 weeks for a medication to gradually increase to a therapeutic dose, as often we cannot start the patient with a dose of the medication that's right because of the potential side effects. Now, take into consideration that it would take 2 to 3 weeks after a patient is on the right dose for that effect of the medication to appear. So I always tell the patient to have the right expectations, agreeing to a medical plan, because often the regimens are not light switches.
So basically the patient is the one who has to stick to taking the medication consistently and taking it the way that you've told them to take it and be patient. And I guess when patients are in pain, that could be a difficult thing to do because of obviously they want their pain to go away immediately. And I guess that doesn't always happen.
Very much so. Very much so. Having the right expectations going into a pain plan or any kind of medical plan and knowing about the risks, benefits, and the time process is very important.
After evaluating the patient, finding out what the other conditions are and you know what the general state of their health is and what their problem is, what is the next step that you take?
So let's go through that conservative management methodology. The first step is to use medications. I use several types of medications. The first type is the over-the-counter medications, ibuprofen, naproxen, Tylenol. A lot of patients may be familiar with these class of medication. They are good when they are given in a therapeutic dosage, which means that if they take the right medication, the right amount of it, at the right times, then they may have the maximum amount of pain relief. Many of the patients have tried the same medication at home, but sometimes when I offer those to the patient, they are a little bit hesitant because they already tried and they have done pain relief, but they don't pay attention that they may not have used the right dosage and frequency. That's why the result may have been suboptimal. With the over-the-counter medications, sometimes the patient don't notice that they may have side effects, and that's absolutely false. Just to make an example, if the patient takes more Tylenol, that's what's advised, they may have liver injury, or in case of ibuprofen, they may have kidney injury or gastrointestinal bleed, or even a heart attack or a stroke. Again, it's important for myself or other practitioners to evaluate patients and based on their overall health status, recommend a safe medication and right dosage for the patients. The second type of medication that I commonly use is medications that increase serotonin, which is a hormone inside our body that makes us feel good. This hormone is often regulated in antidepressant medications. That's why some of the antidepressant medication is commonly used in pain management as well. Mood affects pain, as we know. We talked about the role of psychological problems in pain and vice versa in the last show. Both can lead into each other. Uncontrolled chronic pain for months and years will lead to depression, and depression by itself upregulates pathways involving comprehension of the pain, as you know.
Are you saying basically that the pain leads to depression, and the depression basically is what creating pathways in the brain that are causing more pain, and it's just like a vicious cycle?
That's absolutely correct. Mary Frances, we talked about it, I think, in the past show of how these things are interrelated to each other, and treatment of both conditions are absolutely necessary for a patient to feel good overall. For example, in particular pain conditions such as fibromyalgia and chronic pain, role of psychological factors is even bolder, and that's why some antidepressant medication work better than the other ones to treat pain while treating depression simultaneously as well.
Maybe I misunderstood you, but are you saying that some types of pain are more likely to cause depression than others?
I think the better way of saying is that there are pain conditions, such as fibromyalgia or chronic pelvic pain, that are more common to find in these patients. Other factors of psychological problems, such as depression. Let's talk about pelvic pain, for instance. It's a sensitive area. People who have pelvic pain for a period of time, they might be depressed because of the nature of the pain, or it might be vice versa too. So it's very complicated, but we know that in some pain conditions, the frequency of having those psychological problems is higher.
So after you have tried these over-the-counter medications and you've addressed the psychological aspects, then what would be the next step that you would take with your patients?
The other class of medication that I commonly use is what simply we can put it as anti-seizure class of medication. As we know, seizure happens when nerves in the brain start firing randomly. Basically, we should ask what happens if the nerves in control of the pain get seizures. Then they start firing frequently, and that's why people feel pain out of control. These class of medication help to calm down and relax those nerves, and by that, helping patients get some relief. Gabapentin and Lyrica are good examples of those medications.
So you're saying that the way that the nerves fire when you have pain can be similar to the way that the nerves fire when someone has a seizure. So you're using these anti-seizure medications to help calm down maybe the firing of those nerves so you don't feel as much pain?
Absolutely. That's very correct. It's often the case that even after that trigger is removed that we still feel the pain. And that's a process that could be peripheral or central in nature. And these medications help to lower that frequency of firing of those nerves that don't depend on that trigger anymore to calm down and relax.
Okay, so you're saying that even if someone, like say they had a burn, the burn causes a lot of pain, the burn heals, and there can still be pain there?
Correct. A good example of a pathology is shingles. Sometimes shingles, people get a good rash, the rash resolves, but the pain persists. There's no more rash anymore, but the pain is there because those nerves are not firing correct.
I have never thought of pain as something that would be independent of the thing that caused it in the first place.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah, it is. This is a totally new idea. That it also sounds like a very miserable situation for the patient.
Absolutely.
So after the anti-seizure medications, then is there a next step after that?
Sure. We have other remedies such as muscle relaxant that are really good for myalgias or muscle spasm pain. And lastly, we can talk about opioids that we talked briefly in the last show about, that there are only few indications for these class of medication because of the risk profile and the risk of dependency for patients being on these medications. Therefore, I commonly use them for patients who have terminal disease or pathologies such as cancer, or they are post-operative after a surgical procedure.
So then after the opioids and these different medications, are there methods that you use that are not the medications?
Right. So I think the next step of the pain management, or maybe a better word would be parallel to administering medication, I tend to engage patients with physical therapy. The overall goal of pain management, as we discussed previously, is to increase function and core strength. Sometimes patients have to learn how to move in spite of pain or an injury. When we function, and the way we function absolutely affects our pain. Our posture can significantly affect pain secondary, for example, to a spinal canal narrowing or pain from arthritis of the spine. It is of great value that we have such a service available at Rush Memorial, and that patient can get these exercises and get trained about them through our very highly educated and professional staff at Physical Therapy Department.
You mentioned posture. So are you saying that there are some conditions that affect your posture, or that your posture can affect pain? Because, you know, I was always telling my children, stand up straight. And of course, I'm looking to see, okay, was there more to this than I thought? Is there a relationship between good posture and pain?
I think it's the story of the chicken was the first or the egg. It goes both ways. When you have a pathology, your posture increases or decreases the space in your spine, depending what kind of problem is wrong, whether you have arthritis or narrowing in the canal, or the where the nerves are coming out from the foramen. Also, if you have a bad posture chronically over a long period of time, then that could cause to early arthritis of your spine or sooner presentation of the pain.
You also mentioned physical therapy, and this kind of reminds me of what you were saying about medication. I know that you said some of these medications take weeks to work, and I know physical therapy also is not like a light switch.
Right.
It's something where you have to persevere. You have to do exactly what your therapist tells you to do. You have to do your exercises at home. And this, again, I guess is another thing where the patient just has to really stick to what they're being told to do and be patient, because this does take time.
There is a similar process, as we discussed, with physical therapy as well. Where you go for initially and you get that initial evaluation and treatment plan, and not only you participate in the sessions with the physical therapy department, but also they help you to have a home exercise program where you are basically committing to those exercises and doing them regularly at home.
So the patient, again, is really participating in their own healing.
That's where no policing happens. It's the commitment of the patient to their own health that makes that difference, the biggest difference.
It doesn't sound like it's really easy to be a pain management patient.
No. I think being a patient in general is not easy.
It's not easy,
right?
Yes.
Right? So it's all of us had homework at the school, but really getting that homework done the way we should have is the question of, that's the interest of the patient, of how much they would like to get better.
So after the physical therapy then, is there another component that is necessary?
So that's when we talk about the psychiatric component again. It sounds like a common area where things try to come back, and one of the common ones is the psychiatric component. So depression, anxiety, stress all feed into the intensity of the pain. Unfortunately, these factors are often underdiagnosed. This is more prevalent in rural communities. The goal of this modality of therapy is not only to treat the psychological comorbidities such as anxiety or depression, but more importantly is to give insights to the patients to get to know themselves. We receive many stimuli during the day, and we respond to those by forming reactions. Now, some of those reactions are constructive and some of them are not so much. In case of the pain, the insight helps us better control, cope with, or route our feelings. so we can avoid getting into that vicious cycle we talked about. Cognitive behavioral therapy, mindfulness, exercises, and biofeedback are just examples of therapies that can happen in pain psychology sessions.
I can see that completely, that you really need to treat the whole person. And then you do have some more extreme forms of intervention, do you not?
One of the treatments that I often tell the patients once they exhaust the conservative management is the procedural interventions. These can be therapeutic or diagnostic. For example, if there's too much fluid in a joint, the pain and swelling can be relieved by aspirating or extracting the fluid off the joint. This fluid then can be tested in order to find out what is causing that swelling. Is it infection? Is it just the swelling because of arthritis or gout or etc.? Injections also can put medications into the joint, such as the steroids to relieve pain or materials that help to provide a better cushion for the joint. We can use treatments that involve numbing the nerves that are causing pain. Good example of these procedures can be nerve blocks or ablations. First, the nerves are numb temporarily. This allows me or other provider to see if the nerves are truly causing the pain or not. If that temporary numbing helps and improve patient function and provide them some pain relief, then we can proceed with the ablation or the long-term relief that can last between 4 to 6 months or even up to a year or two. Ablation is a process whereby we can use either heat or cold or other processes to try to denervate a nerve that's causing pain. Pain is a very fascinating subject. Sometimes the pain creates a pathway in the brain that continues even after the cause of the pain is gone. We talked about the phantom limb pain, so let's talk about it now. This occurs when someone feels the pain in an amputated limb, for instance. When this occurs, the next stage of treatment is using modalities that help upregulate neurotransmitters in the brain. Those are the hormones, basically, in our brain. There are a lot of technological advancement in this part of medicine. For example, now we have neuromodulation, where we are able to implant devices that help with the transmission of signals all the way from the peripheral sides to the brain. For now, most of the implants that we have is either for peripheral nerves or for a spinal cord, and that's where we try to intervene with the nerve signaling the pain to the brain.
Thank you so much for coming in today and explaining all of this. There is a lot more to
Absolutely.
Pain management than I could ever have imagined. So thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
You can listen to past shows of To Your Health. Log on to RushMemorial.com and click on podcasts. Join us again next week for another visit with Rush Memorial Hospital. It's To Your Health, brought to you by Rush Memorial Hospital on Hometown Country 94.3 WIFE. The proceeding was a paid presentation. The views and opinions expressed do not necessarily reflect those of WIFE or Whitewater Broadcasting.